All right, let's regroup. Even if you're not finished, that's fine. This is meant just to be a tool. It's meant to be a tool to try and force us to think about plots. Just be careful that we don't mix up genre and plot. So we're talking about comedy not in terms of being funny as a genre. We're talking about comedy in terms of a plot. Okay? There's a difference. So it's the way the story traces, tracing the story line. Right, let's get going with those. Some of you may find these quite difficult. Maybe you've had to look some of the passages up. I do say to people, it's worth us getting the whole Bible under our belt at some point. I think we do read the Bible in two ways, or we should read the Bible in two ways. One is for content, so you do that devotionally, and you spend a lot of time on a small amount of text. But we do also need to be reading our Bibles for mileage, just to get through vast amounts of the Bible in order to understand that these stories do exist. I don't know how many times you've read through the Bible in your Christian life. It's worth doing. It's a very valuable exercise. So as a church, recently, a couple of years ago, we read through the whole Bible together as a church. It took us, 4 or 5 years to do so. We were tackling one book every single month, just dividing the whole book up and just getting through it in our home groups, getting through it on a Sunday morning, and just getting through the whole Bible. And what was amazing was to see how many people came across stuff in the Bible that they'd never seen before, some stuff which they found quite disturbing. And that's quite an insight as well, because it means that the kind of God who's being revealed in the Bible is the kind of God that you've not quite figured out. And I think it's important that we engage with those stories in order to hone our understanding of what God is like. I've recently discovered that the YouVersion Bible app is a wonderful, wonderful thing. I spend an hour and a half on the motorways every single day of my life. I'm so sick of listening to the radio. If I hear the word Brexit one more time, I think I'm going to throw up. So I rather than doing that, and rather than getting in a rage about that, I find the YouVersion Bible app. You can click play. They're wonderful Bible reading plans. You could get through the entire Bible in how long, do you think? 90 days. There's a 90-day Bible reading plan, and I find that I can get an entire day's worth of reading done in the hour and a half commute to and from work. So think about that. Okay, you're not engaging with it at the same level as if you were reading it, but every now and again your ear pricks up something, you say, okay, that's interesting. I glance down at the screen just to see what the chapter is, and I'll have a look at it when I get to the office or get home, just to get through that so you understand that these stories exist. That's the way that I discovered Amos chapter 3, verse 7. I wasn't doing a study in Amos. That verse pricked my attention as I heard it being read. I thought, hang on a second, that's a great verse. It's one worth remembering. Okay, let's go through these stories. David and Goliath. Overcoming the monster. Classic overcoming the monster, yes. Ruth. In the story of Ruth. Sorry, comedy? Okay. In what sense is it a comedy? It's a rom-com. Yes, that's not the kind of comedy we're looking for, okay? Okay, someone said Voyage and Return. Why did you say Voyage and Return? From whose perspective? But you're right. You're right. So if I'm looking at from Naomi, you see, because the rags to riches doesn't really help me with the first two chapters. So the story as a whole is actually a voyage and return. From Naomi's perspective, it's a voyage and return. And in fact, her name changes as a result of the experience. You're absolutely right. She goes to Moab. They leave the house, a place called Bethlehem, called the House of Bread. There was no bread. They go searching amongst Israel's enemies, and they come back. And she even changes her name. She goes from being Naomi, which means pleasant, to being Mara, which is bitter. Why? Because of her experience being away. So from Naomi's perspective, definitely a voyage and return. But if we're focusing on the Ruth side of the story, what have we got? We've got a rags to riches. So do you see how we can... depends how we're going to tell the story. So I suppose if I was to do this as a two-part series, then I might, if I was to do that. In fact, that's what we did. So the first part is really a journey and return plot. The second part is a rags to riches plot. Okay, now why are we doing this? Well, we're doing this because it helps us to think about character development. It helps us to think about the climax of the story, where the turning point is, where the tension is, all those sorts of things. Okay? So it depends which perspective you're going to take. What about the resurrection? Okay. Or rebirth. Okay, so remember that the whole idea behind that is your hero is in a state of living death or dead, in this case, and that miraculously they're alive again. So now you're looking broader than just the resurrection. You see, so this is why it's important for us to think about these things. Because it depends how much text you're going to cover. I mean, you could say Jesus was on a journey and return from heaven to earth and back again. Except you're not going to cover everything in one lesson. Do you see what I'm saying? So it depends where you divide that narrative up, as we've just seen with the Ruth story. Now, this may not be cut and dried, but it's forcing us to think. That's the point. Okay? All right, so probably rebirth or the resurrection. What about the 12 spies going out in Numbers 13? Interesting. That is a tragedy in one sense. In another sense, the tragedy is more about someone being gripped and there's sort of this downward spiral. So it gets worse and worse and worse. It's not just a single tragic event. Does that make sense? So if we want to distinguish that from some of the others. So I would think that the wilderness experience as a whole could be considered to be a tragedy as things get worse and worse and worse. And the book of Judges certainly is a tragedy where things get worse and worse and worse and worse until you get to Judges chapter 19, which is unthinkable. Okay. What else might it be? A quest. They're going out in search of something. Okay. You might get away with a journey and return. You might get away with that. When you think about how the characters change, you've got Joshua and Caleb who are emboldened by the journey and the return. And you've got the other 10 spies who are terrified as a result of it. So you could think of it in that term, in those terms as well. Now, what you're going to probably land up finding is that you may settle on a plot and then you spend more time working the text and you say, actually, no, the text is actually pushing this. I might need to modify my plot a little bit. I might need to reevaluate it in terms of the thrust that I'm going to give in the lesson. Okay, what about Naaman? Comedy. Sorry? Comedy. A comedy? Why is it a comedy? Okay. Okay. Yeah. Did anybody else? Are there a lot of obstructions in Naaman's thing besides his stubbornness? Could be maybe a bit of a rebirth, although he's not really the hero in the story and he's not really being repressed to the point of death. Perhaps, eh? Voyage and return. So we have him, we think about it, he's changed, isn't he? He's changed. He's changed physically, and I think we get a hint that he's changed spiritually. So he makes the voyage down, he's changed by his experience, and he goes back. A voyage and return. All right, what about Balaam's donkey? That's a comedy, not just because you've got a donkey speaking, but because you've got this recurring theme. So if you get the geography right in your head, you've got Israel east of the Jordan, waiting to cross over the Jordan. You've got these three hilltops. And you've got Balaam coming to curse Israel as they're about to cross over into the Jordan from these three hilltops. And he tries from the one and it doesn't work. And he tries from the other and it doesn't work. And he tries from the other and it still doesn't work. That doesn't really get resolved in the end because he's tried from three different locations, but actually it lands up blessing. It turns on itself. Okay, I don't even think Israel were aware what was going on. Think about what that must have been like. Millions. We're talking millions of people in an area and a bloke somewhere over there cursing them from a hilltop. I don't even think they knew what was going on. Okay. What about the wise men? Quest. Yes. There's not really much about their return journey. What about, we've already discussed this actually, Naomi in the story of Ruth. Yeah. What about Solomon? Tragedy. That's a terrible tragedy. Okay, do you see how it goes over a period of time? It gets worse and worse and worse and worse. What about Gideon? Overcoming the monster. That cycle seems to repeat itself a number of times in the book of Judges. So, in the sense, the whole book of Judges is a spiral of overcoming the monster stories. So, it's a tragedy of a collection. It's a tragic collection of overcoming the monster stories. What about the sacrifice of Isaac in Genesis 22? It's a rebirth story, isn't it? Okay. What about the prodigal son? Voyage and return. Classic voyage and return. He is changed by experience in the pig pit. Moses at the Red Sea, pinned in by the Egyptian army. It seems to be overcoming the monster. The New Testament seems to talk about the crossing of the Red Sea in rebirth type terms. It refers to it as a kind of baptism, which is interesting. But perhaps overcoming the monster as Pharaoh's armies are finally overcome is perhaps a better plot. The wilderness wanderings? Tragedy? Or quest? They eventually do land up getting to the promised land, don't they? What about Samson? Samson's a tragedy. It's not unlike Solomon. What about sending out of the 12 disciples in Mark 6? Voyage and return. They go out, they come back. They've learned something. They've been challenged and changed in some way. Paul in prison in Acts 16. Yes. Yeah. When they go to the jail. Yes. The earthquake, the chains fell off, but they don't run away. And the jailer comes and he wants to kill himself, and then they said, no, don't worry, you know, and then they get converted through the whole process. So we were talking about that. It's an interesting plot. You've got to remember that God is active in this process, so you may want to include him. It's a bit like Acts chapter 9 with Saul. Saul on the road to Damascus. What would we describe that as? It might be a rebirth, but also might be an overcoming the monster. Jesus is active in that situation, isn't he? If you were trying to set up a cast, you would need someone to be the voice of Jesus. So that's also one way to think about it. So it's Jesus overcoming the monster Saul. And he doesn't only overcome the monster, he recruits the monster. So there's your plot twist. Okay, he doesn't just... Yes, yes. Yeah, although we're not told much about his return journey. So he sort of gets there, but, you know, and then he becomes totally different and starts recruiting. So he doesn't, there's no return journey as such. Okay, but yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter which way you want to play it. It means we're thinking about the plot. Okay. What about Jesus' temptation? In Matthew 4. So that's the beginning of his ministry. Overcoming the monster. Yeah, okay. Overcoming the monster. Judas Iscariot? Tragedy. Joseph sold into Egypt? Rags to riches if you take it just from the prison at the bottom all the way up. Or? It's a very tricky one, this one, sorry. Perhaps a rebirth story? Well, he only returns really at the end. Only his bones return a long time later. Yeah, so take the whole life of Joseph. Think about the whole life of Joseph. That is comedic. Yeah, but he doesn't get home, does he? So, but you write with the dreams. With the dreams, we already know how the story is going to end. It's like Pride and Prejudice. You know how the story is going to end. Let's be honest. You know those two are getting together. Come on. You know they're going to get together. It's boy meets girl. It's classic plot. They're going to get together. It's just how, okay? It's just a case of how, okay? There is one line in there that I absolutely love, of course. It's when he tells his daughter, from this day forward, you'll be a stranger to one of your two parents. That is absolutely brilliant. There is another one which I'm waiting to use. And when he says, dear Lizzie, I could not think of parting with you to anyone more worthy. I'm hoping that one day my daughter will find someone worthy. Right. Yeah. I think it's true for all of us. Very good. Great. I will go and search for them the next time we have to watch it. Okay, the next time I've got like 6 hours of my life. I know. It's a labor of love. Sorry? You can't let my wife know that I've quoted so much of it, okay? It's my trump card. Where were we? We were talking about Joseph's life. So we know at the beginning already from the dream that this is how it's going to end. It just takes forever to get there. So it's got this comedic aspect where, you know, now he's going to die. No, he's not going to die. He's going to get sold as a slave. But it's the slave of Potiphar, who's a prominent man. So that's okay. And he gets put in charge of Potiphar's household. So that's good. But then his wife accuses him of whatever she accuses him of. And then, of course, he gets put into prison. But then he rises to prominence in the prison. And then we think it's going to be okay. And then it's not okay. And then he interprets someone's dream. And then he thinks it's going to be okay because they're going to remember him. And do you see how we're going with the story? And then he gets forgotten. And it's right down there. And then all of a sudden, there's liberation at the end. It all gets resolved very quickly at the end. Okay? That is what life is like, okay? You've got this cycle with him. You know where it's going to go, but it takes a very, very long time to get there. So if you want to use the comedy plot for the whole of Joseph's life, good and well. If you want to think about it as rags to riches from him, just from the prison perspective. So it really does depend how you're going to divide the story up. And sometimes if you're struggling with the plot, sometimes you say to yourself, am I covering enough text? Am I covering enough of the story? If you're struggling to come up with a plot, then maybe you're not thinking of enough story. You don't have enough material to cover it properly. Does it make sense? So you've only got one chapter out of the book, but actually you need the next chapter. Or you need the whole book. Consider it as a whole. That's what it means to consider these things in context. Okay? Right. Let's think about the healing of the demoniac in Luke 8. Okay. The man, he's naked, he's chained up, he's breaking the chains, he meets Jesus, and he's sitting in his right mind, and he's clothed. Rebirth, rags to riches. Yeah, one of those. Yeah. Okay. So his encounter with Jesus changes him forever. Okay? Was that a bit of fun? Yeah? Forcing us to think about plot lines in narrative. We're going to spend some time thinking about how we go about preparing the story, and then we'll take a break for coffee, and then we'll come back and think about presentation ideas, and we'll do a lot more group work. When we think about preparing the story, we've got to think about the story as a whole. Stories have a tension. Sometimes that's created in the beginning of the story. There's a tension which needs to be resolved. It normally gets resolved by the end of the story, and then there's a middle returning point where we can see that this tension is going to be resolved. So it's worth asking the question, where is the tension in the story? What is the issue in the story that needs to be resolved? Because you need to build up to that. That's where you're going to gain their interest, in one sense. There's elements within the structure of the story that we need to think about. The first thing we need to think about is the pace of the text. How quickly is this text moving? Okay. There may well be a time factor which is outside of the text, which could be, you know, 20 to 100 years. So you've got the story of Abraham, you know, it may give you a chapter of his life, but actually it's not a chapter of his life, it's 20, 40, 50 years of his life covered in that chapter. Or Abraham's life as a whole. And if you don't consider the time factor outside, I think we lack sympathy. We lack sympathy with Abraham because we don't realize how long he's waited for this. If you think how long he had waited for that first child to be born, I think you can be sympathetic. There is a time factor outside of the actual story. Within the story itself, the pace also changes. So if you take Genesis chapter 22, the sacrifice of Isaac, into account, the story goes at a certain pace. It slows down quite deliberately as they're going to the place of sacrifice. And we'll talk more about that in a minute. And then it speeds up again as it reaches that crescendo, is about to kill his son. And then it sort of halts and pauses. And then there's a long cooling down period. Okay? So just think about the pace within the story. Is it building the tension in some way? Think about the narrator's comments. So sometimes you've got the narrator making a comment within the story, which helps us to understand the story. You've got this repeated phrase in Judges chapter 21, verse 25. It comes up again and again. It says, "In those days Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit." So because that keeps coming up, now the only reason you're going to know that it keeps coming up is you've read the whole book of Judges. So that's what you really want to do. You want to say, "I want to read the whole book of Judges so that I can teach the story in its context." And so you get this recurring theme. In those days Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit. Okay, now it's looking forward to kingship. Most likely a comment that was added in afterwards, but it's looking forward to kingship. Okay, here's another narrator's comment in John 4:9. "The Samaritan woman said to him, 'You are a Jew and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans.'" So do you understand the tension in the story? We're living in a world where, we're encouraged to be multicultural, to not be racist, to not be misogynist. So we kind of don't get this idea. She says to him, "You are speaking to me. Not only am I a Samaritan, but I am a woman. You should not be doing this." So if I'm going to teach the story properly, I've got to try and help my children understand that. And I only get that because of the narrator's comment. What about repetition? Repetition is the Bible's way of underlining or highlighting things for us. Okay, let me give you a couple of examples. If you've got Bibles with you, 1 Kings chapter 17. 1 Kings 17 from verse 2. "Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah, 'Leave here, turn eastward and hide in the Kirith ravine east of the Jordan. You will drink from the brook, and I have directed the ravens to supply you with food there.'" Verse 5. "So he did what the Lord had told him. He went to the Kirith ravine east of the Jordan and stayed there. The ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook." Now, I don't know about you, but I could summarize that paragraph quite easily. I could stop at verse 5, "So he did what the Lord had told him." It's almost laborious in terms of the detail that's given to us. But it happens a number of times in this book, in this particular chapter. So look at 17, verse 8 to 9. "Then the word of the Lord came to him, 'Go at once to Zarephath in the region of Sidon and stay there. I have directed a widow there to supply you with food.'" You ready for it? "So he went to Zarephath. When he came to the town gate, a widow was there gathering sticks. He called to her and asked, 'Would you bring me a little water in a jar so I may have a drink?' As she was going to get it, he called, 'And bring me, please, a piece of bread.'" So you've got this repetition. And you will find that it's got to do with the word of the Lord. At that time in Israel, you've got Ahab and his cohort Jezebel, who are ignoring the word of the Lord. That's why the challenge which is laid down in chapter 17, verse 1, says, "Now Elijah the Tishbite from Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, 'As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who I serve, There will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years except at my word. So every time the word of the Lord comes up, he's showing us that Elijah very carefully keeps every single detail of God's word. So you will go to the Kirith ravine, it's east of the Jordan, there you will stay. You'll be fed by the ravens, you'll drink from the brook. So Elijah went to the Kirith ravine, which is east of the Jordan. Do you see what I'm saying? It's almost laborious in the way that it repeats everything. But it's showing us complete and absolute fulfillment of God's word, which Ahab and Jezebel were not doing. And the irony in the story comes in the words of the widow in chapters 17, verse 16. So yeah, we've got more of this example. For the jar of flour was not used up, and the jug of oil did not run dry, in keeping with the word of the Lord spoken by Elijah. So there again, you've got the word of the Lord being kept. And then 17:24, the irony in the words of the widow. She says, then the woman said to Elijah, "Now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord from your mouth is truth." So as you're reading through this chapter, you're coming across this constant refrain, the word of the Lord. You're coming across situations where the word of the Lord is being kept. You've got the irony of Ahab not keeping the word of the Lord. The irony of a foreign woman who does not worship God acknowledging that the word of the Lord in his mouth is truth. Do you see that? So it's those kinds of repetitions that we are looking for as we engage with the stories. Chapter 18, verse 1 is another. Just have a look at that. After a long time, in the third year, the word of the Lord came to Elijah, "Go and present yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the land." So Elijah went to present himself to Ahab. Okay? It's this whole idea of the word of the Lord being very carefully fulfilled. Let's go to Joshua chapter 7 for another quick example. And this is where I think it's helpful to read broader than simply the text you've been given, because it helps us to understand where that narrative should really start and where it should end. So chapter 7, verse 26. Do you know the story of Achan? Israel have gone to fight against Ai. They've got their butts seriously whipped. Before they fight against Ai, they've gone to plunder. And of course the Lord said that you are to, with Jericho, you are to reserve these things for me. Achan has hidden some of these things. They've gone to fight against Ai and been absolutely whipped because Achan had hidden these devoted things. He's discovered and he is stoned. And 7:26 says, "Over Achan they heaped up a large pile of rocks, which remains to this day. Then the Lord turned from his fierce anger, therefore, and the place will be called the Valley of Achor ever since." So we've got this idea that something's been done which is wrong. And there's a pile of rocks that forms a memorial for that. They then go to fight against Ai, and they win. And then we've got in 8 verse 29, we've got these words. "He impaled the body of the king of Ai on a pole and left it there until evening. At sunset," which would have been in accordance with Jewish law, what would have happened? "Joshua ordered them to take the body from the pole and throw it down at the entrance of the city gate. And they raised a large pile of rocks over it, which remains to this day." So you see, you've got that phrase, this large pile of rocks, which sort of opens the story, and the large pile of rocks ending the story. It's repetition. And it's helping us to understand what's going on. The first pile of rocks over Achan was to remind us that we have not obeyed the word of the Lord. The second pile of rocks shows us that there is victory when we do obey the word of the Lord. Okay, so that story ties together in that way. And if you read broader than the text, you'll understand that maybe you need more text in order for the story to properly make sense. So repetition. Make a note of repetition. You know, Bible Gateway is a great gift to us. You can read many translations of the Bible. You don't have to have them all on your bookshelf. You can print them out. You can mark it. You can scratch things out. You can circle things. You can underline things. It's a great way to study the Bible. What is the mood of the story? Is there tension? Is there surprise? How does it end? Is it happiness? Is it sorrow? What is the mood of the story? Who dominates the stage? You know, there's a protagonist in the story of David. He's David. You've got the antagonist, who is Goliath. And then you've got a foil. You've often got a foil in the story. He's the character that's brought up behind the protagonist to highlight the protagonist, to make him look even better. In the story of David and Goliath, the foil is Saul. Saul is a pathetic figure. He's trembling there with his men. He doesn't know what to do. And yeah, this young shepherd boy comes along. And he says, "You just got to trust God, mate. You just got to trust God. He'll deliver us. How can you allow this man, this heathen, to mock and malign the Lord? How can you do that? You're the king." So Saul becomes the foil. And David looks so much better behind Saul, in front of Saul, doesn't he? You see the same thing in Acts chapter 5. Acts chapter 5, let's go. That's the story of Ananias and Sapphira. Do you know the story? So you've got the story of Ananias and Sapphira in Acts chapter 5. But I don't think, unless you go to Acts chapter 4, we don't really understand what's going on here. See? The issue here is not, if I don't give my money, God's going to kill me. The issue here is very clearly in Acts chapter 4, actually. So you've got to realize that, of course, the chapters and the verses were put in later. And sometimes they're unhelpful because they force us to think in a particular way. So the story actually starts in Acts 4:32. All the believers were one in heart and mind. No one claimed that any of their possessions was their own, but they shared everything they had. With great power, the apostles continued to testify to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus. And God's grace was so powerfully at work in all of them that there were no needy persons among them. For from time to time, those who owned land or houses sold them, brought the money from the sales, and put it at the feet of the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to everyone who had need. Joseph, a Levite from Cyprus, whom the apostles called Barnabas, which means son of encouragement, sold a field he owned and brought the money and put it at the apostles' feet. Now a man named Ananias, together with his wife Sapphira, also sold a piece of property. With his wife's full knowledge, he kept back part of the money for himself, but brought the rest and put it at the apostles' feet. Then Peter said, "Ananias, how is it that Satan has filled your heart, that you have lied to the Holy Spirit and have kept for yourself some of the money you received for the land? Didn't it belong to you before it was sold? And after it was sold, wasn't the money at your disposal? What made you think of doing such a thing? You have not lied. You have not lied just to human beings, but to God." And of course, he falls down dead. So do you see how Barnabas becomes the foil? Barnabas is the foil. He comes up. He is the example of someone who has given generously. Okay? Now, I think the issue here with Ananias and Sapphira is not the fact that they've held back some money, but that they've pretended that that was all. That's the issue. So Barnabas comes generously giving all the money. These people hold back. So there's this idea of hypocrisy coming through. But you only really get that if you look at the Barnabas story behind the Ananias story. It helps us to interpret that story. Okay? And you see there how a chapter division is very unhelpful. So if I was teaching this passage, I would definitely start in chapter 4. I would start with the story of Barnabas. Okay? In order to contrast the two and to show the shortfall of Ananias and Sapphira. Okay? The money was at their disposal. They could have done whatever they wished, but they chose to pretend that they were being more generous than they really were. That's the issue. It's the issue of hypocrisy. All right. Are there other characters in the story? And it's worth asking the question, who knows what? Who knows what in the story? So the disciples in Mark chapter 1, verse 1, they know nothing. But you already know everything. Mark chapter 1 says that this is the beginning of the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. He's given the game away. My kids have just recently got into Agatha Christie, and they watched Murder on the Orient Express, and now every Agatha Christie story is what they're after. But, you know, there's a sense in which that's often given away in the beginning. So we're given that sort of sense in Mark chapter 1. We know that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, but they don't. And so from their perspective, once again, you can be sympathetic. You can be sympathetic as you understand, what did they actually know? Could they possibly have known? No, they couldn't have known. So I think sometimes we're quite harsh on the disciples. But actually, they don't really get it until Acts chapter 2. It's only in Acts chapter 2 that Peter begins to talk about a suffering Christ. Before that, he didn't want to know anything about that. It's worth asking things like what Abraham knows as he goes to sacrifice his son. What does he know? What could he know? What does Isaac know? What can't Isaac know? Different characters in the story. What about other Bible references? Is this story referenced anywhere else in the Bible? Okay. Can the Bible give me a clue as to what's going on anywhere else? Let's just pick up Hebrews chapter 11 quickly. As we think a little bit more about Abraham in Genesis 22. So, I mean, the question really is, what could Abraham know? You know, he makes that comment in Genesis. He says to the servants, you wait here, we are going to go there, and then we are going to come back. Should he not have said, we are going to go there, and then I'm going to come back? Was he really going to kill his son? Was he calling God's bluff? As he raises that dagger, was he thinking to himself, I'm sure at some point God's going to stop me. What if he doesn't? What if I don't hear him? What's going on in his mind? Well, Hebrews chapter 11 tells us exactly what's going on in his mind. Verse 17. For by faith Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had embraced the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, it is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. Abraham reasoned that God could even raise the dead. And so in a manner of speaking, he did receive Isaac back from death. Isn't that astonishing? Abraham doesn't go to sacrifice his son hoping that God will give him another son. In fact, at the beginning of the Genesis account, it says, take your son, your only son, the one whom you love, even Isaac. There were no other sons around. Ishmael was gone long ago. It couldn't have been anybody else. Take your son, your only son, the one whom you love, even Isaac, and kill him. Isaac represents everything that Abraham has lived for. Many, many, many years ago, God promised that he'd give him a child, that this boy Isaac would be the one through whom all the promises that he had lived for since he left his family so far away, Isaac represented that. Now kill him. Abraham reasoned that God could raise the dead. So when Abraham says, we are going to go over there and we are going to come back, he fully believes it. Does that mean he's not going to kill his son? No, he is going to kill his son. And he reasoned that God could raise the dead. How did Abraham know that God could raise the dead? Well, Romans chapter 4 tells us very clearly. Because Abraham believed in the God who raises the dead. Because he says his body was as good as dead in Romans chapter 4. And his wife's womb was also dead, Romans chapter 4. But God brought life. So based on God's previous history, I know that God can bring dead things to life. It's fascinating, isn't it, that three religions in the world trace their heritage back to Abraham. And remarkably, only one believes in a resurrection. Only one really trusts in the God who raises the dead. There is great similarity between Abraham's faith and my faith because we both believe in the God who raises the dead. Now, so I've gone to another passage in the Bible. Do you see that? I've got an interpretive key back into the Old Testament in order to understand what's going on. Is it referenced elsewhere in the Bible? Another example of this would be if you had to go, we're running out of time, but 1 Corinthians chapter 10 verse 1 to 6 tells us how to understand the Exodus and the wilderness wanderings. Okay? So 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 1 to 6. You can just make a note of that. What about the dialogue embedded in the story? So there's a dialogue that goes on in the story. Let's go to Genesis 22. Sorry, it's a happy hunting ground for me. We translated this from the Hebrew when I was at college, and I've just absolutely, it's an amazing, amazing story. Genesis chapter 22. Notice this little conversation that goes on here. It's the dialogue that's in the story. Okay, I'm picking it up from verse 5. He said to his servant, stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship and then we will come back to you. Abraham took the fire, took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them went on together, notice that phrase, Isaac spoke up and said to his father, Father, yes, my son, Abraham replied. The fire and the wood are here, said Isaac, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? Abraham answered, God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And the two of them went on together. So you've got a little inclusio over there. It starts with the phrase, and the two of them went on together. And it ends with the phrase, and the two of them went on together. And what's happened there is that between those two is a deep concentration on a wonderful dialogue between a father and a son. Granted, Isaac is asking awkward questions. But notice there, notice this deep relationship there. He says there, Isaac spoke up and said to his father, Abraham, Father, yes, my son, Abraham replied. And then at the end there, he says, God himself will provide the burnt offering, my son. So it's emphasizing the relationship of father-son. It's a very deep relationship. It's a wonderful relationship. Which is why right at the beginning, which we unfortunately miss in the English, God actually says please to Abraham in verse 1. It's verse 2. He actually says please. In fact, he says please in the same way that you would request something from a king. If you, a commoner, were to go and approach a king for something and ask, how would you ask? You'd ask incredibly politely. It's exactly the same way that God asks Abraham to do what he's asking him to do, because he knows the enormity of the task that he's asking him to perform. Okay? But even without that, I can understand that you notice the text has slowed down at that point in order to highlight the relationship between Abraham and his son. There's dialogue embedded in the text. Yeah. Sure.
Because we don't have the answer.
Yeah. No child has ever asked me that question. So I'm wanting to know if a child has asked that question, I would say something like, well, the Bible doesn't tell us about how he must have been feeling. I imagine he would have been afraid. I would have imagined it would be a very, very difficult thing for a man to tie up his son in this way and do this. It also depends what age group you're talking about. You see? So how far am I going to go with that?
We have sort of 8, 9, 10.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, at that stage, they're engaging with the scriptures. It's there. So it's in one sense, you know, it's all there. They've got to learn to engage with this. They've got to learn to understand what God is like, even with that text. So they may well ask, I don't know what their relationship was like. We're not told. That's not the focus of the story. The focus of the story is Abraham's confidence, despite the love that he had for his son. Because it's clear that he loved his son. He's not an abusive father. He loved his son very dearly. I think the narrator brings that out very clearly and speaks against those who say that Abraham was an abusive father. In no way. In that sense, this is totally, totally out of character for Isaac, for Abraham. So, and to what extent did Isaac understand that Abraham was acting in obedience? You see, that would change things as well, wouldn't it? If a child knew that he was acting in obedience. And what sort of faith does Isaac have? Well, he actually grows up to have a very strong faith. So far from putting him off his faith, it actually strengthens his faith, doesn't it? So we've got to be very careful that we don't think about this from an adult's perspective with all the baggage that we have and presuppose questions that children probably won't even ask. Now, if they're older, they may well ask that. You may want to open that can of worms as long as you've thought it through. But if I think about Isaac's life as a whole, this was a strengthening experience for him, not something that put him off. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, but it's also understanding this within the context of faith. So you mean, you know, friends, there's a lot of things that we've got to really get our heads around. One of the things is that we are going to get done for spiritual abuse. It's coming. It's coming. But for a child to understand their own sinfulness in the context of the faith is a very good and wholesome thing. If it's outside of the context of faith, yes, of course, it's abusive. But if it's in the context of faith, it's totally different. It takes on a whole new meaning. So I don't mind my children learning about prostitution and murder and genocide and all these things that we find in the Bible in the context of faith. It's when you divorce it from the context of faith that you land up in a lot of trouble. Okay? So think about the dialogue that is embedded within the text. And then there's the interaction between Elijah and Ahab as well, which is a fascinating dialogue and gives us a key to understanding the story. There will be neither dew nor rain except at my word. 1 Kings chapter 17, verse 1. Now, if you repeatedly read the story, you will gain more insight. So repeated reading, and sometimes repeated reading in different translations is also helpful. Because where there is a difference in the way the two translations have translated a verse, it tells you that it's quite tricky. Okay? So repeated reading of the story brings new insight, and you do want to read it again and again and again. You see, you cannot sit down and prepare your Sunday school lesson or your Bible study on a Saturday evening. There's just not enough time for you to get this into your head. You know, you do a film study, like, shall we just use Pride and Prejudice as an example. Every time you watch that film, you pick up something new. Don't you? Surely. In fact, I don't even think we've plumbed the depths of a magnificent piece of work like that. What could you say? What could you say about the Bible? So if you are teaching, you know, Genesis 22, my suggestion is Monday, read Genesis 22. Tuesday, read Genesis 22. Make that your devotion for the whole week. Just mellow in Genesis 22. Read it again and again and again and again, so that you get these sort of insights. Okay? One last thing before we stop for coffee. Remember, God is the hero of every Bible story. People love to be David when he's killing Goliath. But I've noticed that they don't really identify with David when he's with Bathsheba. Have you noticed that? Sort of pick and choose when we want to be the hero. Constantly trying to find ourselves in the text. You're not in the text. You don't exist in the Bible. You're not there. Okay? So stop trying to identify with the hero. God is the hero of every single Bible story. And that's the problem, is that legalism and moralism lurk. People are constantly trying to find, trying to use the Bible as a lever to get children to be good, rather than helping them to understand that the Bible reveals God's character so that we will trust in Him. So that when their hearts are changed, their behavior will change. So we don't teach nonsense Sunday school lessons by saying that Moses went in a basket and it showed us that we should listen to our parents. That's using the Bible as a lever. Or when Joseph was prince of Egypt, what did he do? Well, he shared his food, didn't he, boys and girls? God loves it when we share our food. Yeah? If someone's not, you know, not brought their lunch for school or something like that, and you could share your lunch, God would be very happy with that. That's not what the story of Joseph's about. Or the story of Mephibosheth. You know, Mephibosheth drops Jonathan's son when he's very young, and he's crippled in both his feet, and when Jonathan and Saul are killed in battle, what does David do? He says, is there anyone from Jonathan's family still alive? And they said, there's only this Mephibosheth. So he says, bring him to me. Now, normally in those times, that child would have been executed because he had a claim to the throne. See? But instead, David says, come, let him dine at my table, a real sign of fellowship. And he looks after him for the rest of his life. Now, you get Sunday school material that says, you know, God wants us to look after disabled people. And the craft activity is children in wheelchairs and crutches and all these sorts of things. And we're encouraged to go and visit children at Great Ormond Street. Now, I'm sure God does want us to look after disabled people. I'm sure it'd be a wonderful thing to go to Gosh. It'd be wonderful to do that. But that's not what the story is teaching. That story is teaching us the covenant faithfulness of God's anointed. He made a covenant with Jonathan, a very strong promise that they would look after each other's families. And he is faithful to that promise. David is a type of Christ who is faithful to all his promises. Because as 1 Corinthians says, no matter how many promises God has made, they are all yes in the person of the Lord Jesus Christ. Okay? That's a much bigger truth for me to get children to get their heads around. Okay? So, avoid that. You need to make God the hero of every Bible story. The Bible is teaching us about God. It's teaching us about his character. He does that through teaching us what he has done with people throughout history, a history which he has written, a history which he has proclaimed, and a history where he has acted. Okay? We're going to stop there for a coffee break. I'm sorry we're a little bit over. But let's stop there for a minute. And we'll do that for about 20 minutes. And then we'll get back. Okay?